So last year, I mean, we all know the story. Millions of tourists literally fighting for like a single square foot of sand on the beaches of Rhodes.
Oh, yeah. The massive resort pools, the booming beach clubs.
Right, the endless sea of identical umbrellas. You know the exact scene we're talking about. But just a few nautical miles away, there is this island so completely isolated that your only neighbors are hunting bottlenose dolphins.
Which is just a wild contrast.
It really is. And so today we're doing a deep dive into the Alimia Marine Life Experience. Our mission here, based on the sources we've got, isn't just to talk about some standard boat tour.
No, definitely not.
We are looking at a highly specific sea-based escape. We're going to deconstruct how navigating the wilder Western maritime routes of the Aegean Light completely rewires the way you experience the Greek islands.
Because it fundamentally changes the equation of travel. I mean, when people visit an island, they usually treat the land as the destination, right?
Right.
And the water is just, well, a scenic backdrop for the hotel.
Yeah, just something pretty to look at from the balcony.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But what these sources reveal is an experience that flips that entirely. The sea itself, you know, the currents, the biology, the submerged topography, that becomes the actual destination.
And the land is just a temporary resting place.
Right.
I want to start with the geography of that flip, actually, because the sources are super specific about where this whole journey begins. It kicks off at Kamiros Skala,
Yeah, a really small harbor.
right on the western coast of Rhodes. Now, considering that almost all the heavy tourist infrastructure, you know, the massive resorts and the commercial ports, they're all clustered on the eastern and northern coasts. So launching from the west feels like a very deliberate choice.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like taking the scenic back roads instead of the tourist-packed main highway. What is the actual, I guess, mechanical difference between the east and west coasts of an island like Rhodes?
Well, it really comes down to geology and wind. The eastern side of Rhodes is the leeward side.
Meaning it's protected.
Yeah, exactly. It's sheltered from the prevailing summer winds, which makes the water exceptionally calm,
Right.
and that allows for those massive, sprawling beach resorts to just operate smoothly.
Right. Nobody wants huge waves ruining their resort pool vibe.
Exactly. But the western side, however, faces the open Aegean and those strong Meltami winds. So it's significantly more rugged. The coastline is steeper. And, well, the maritime character is just much rawer.
Wow. Okay.
So by departing from Kamiros Skala, you are physically bypassing all those heavily engineered tourist zones. You're entering an environment that has maintained its ancient working maritime rhythms.
That makes a ton of sense. I mean, the architecture of a port dictates your whole psychological state.
Oh, 100%.
If you depart from a massive commercial terminal, you know, surrounded by cruise ships and thousands of people rolling suitcases, your brain is just stuck in a state of high-stress logistics.
You're just processing crowds at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But starting at a small, localized harbor like Kamiros Skala, you are essentially stripping away that cognitive load right from the jump. You're priming your brain for observation rather than just like consumption.
Precisely. You transition from the built environment to the natural environment almost immediately. I mean, within minutes of leaving the harbor, the coastline of Rhodes begins to shrink behind you.
Yeah.
And the route opens directly into these smaller islets and quiet sea passages.
Yeah.
So you aren't just moving horizontally across the water, you're moving into an entirely different ecological zone.
Which brings us to the first major ecological shift in the journey. So as the boat pushes into the open sea, it heads toward a specific area surrounding Makri Islet.
Right, Bakri.
And the sources highlight this zone for a very specific reason: bottlenose dolphins. Now, the Aegean is a massive body of water. Why do these highly intelligent apex predators hang out around this one particular rocky outcrop?
Well, it has to do with the bathymetry,
The
the underwater topography, basically the shape of the seafloor. Islands and islets like Makri, they aren't just rocks sitting on top of the water. They are the peaks of submerged mountains.
Oh, wow, right.
So when deep sea currents hit the steep underwater walls of these islets, they are forced upward. And this creates an upwelling, which brings all this colder, nutrient-rich water from the deep straight up toward the sunlight.
And where there are nutrients, I'm guessing there is phytoplankton.
Exactly. The phytoplankton blooms happen, and that attracts massive schools of small pelagic fish. And then naturally, those fish attract the dolphins.
Oh, okay.
So Makri Islet essentially acts as a natural dining room for bottlenose dolphins, just because of how the ocean currents interact with its geology.
Okay, I understand the biology there, but I want to look at the psychology of this for you, the traveler. I've been on wildlife tours before, and well, there is an inherent risk,
Oh,
right?
definitely. The animals don't read the brochure.
Exactly. So if a boat full of people travels all the way out to Macquarie Islet and the water is just totally still, like no fins, no splashing, isn't there a massive risk of disappointment? Why build the trip around something so totally unpredictable?
Because, honestly, the unpredictability is the actual mechanism that engages your brain.
How so?
Well, think about it. If you go to a zoo, you are guaranteed to see the animal, right?
Yeah.
But you are a passive consumer of entertainment. You just stare at an enclosure.
Right.
When you are on a boat in the open ocean, hunting for a glimpse of a wild marine mammal, your posture completely changes. You enter a state of active observation.
You're constantly scanning the horizon.
Right, yeah. You are analyzing the way the light hits the water. You're watching the texture of the waves. You're looking for shadows.
That makes sense.
Even if a dolphin doesn't surface in that exact 5-minute window, the anticipation forces you to be intensely present. It literally recalibrates your attention span.
So the sea stops being just a flat blue highway and becomes a three-dimensional habitat that you are actively trying to read.
Exactly. It's a totally different mindset.
That active observation is powerful. You're basically trying to decode the environment, but naturally, observing the surface of the water only tells half the story.
Right.
If the upwelling of nutrients is happening below and the dolphins are hunting below, the logical next step is to actually break the surface yourself. And according to the sources, that is exactly what happens next.
Yes, the route moves to Stragley Islet for snorkeling.
But the text doesn't just say swimming, it specifically emphasizes guided snorkeling. Now, if I know how to swim, why is a guide so critical to just looking at some rocks underwater?
Well, because the Mediterranean underwater landscape is incredibly nuanced. I mean, this isn't a shallow tropical reef with neon pink coral where everything is just obvious.
Right, it's not a cartoon.
Exactly. The Aegean is characterized by these dramatic rocky drop-offs, deep blue visibility, and very complex ecosystems like Posidonia Oceanica,
Which is?
massive underwater seagrass meadows that are absolutely vital to the health of the sea.
So without a guide, I'm just swimming around looking at grass and rocks.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
You'd be experiencing a phenomenon known as inattentional blindness. You only see what you know to look for.
Oh, wow. Inattentional blindness. That's a great term.
Yeah, to the untrained eye, a rocky crevice is just a dark shadow. But to a guide, that crevice is the hunting ground of an octopus, or maybe the hiding spot of a moray eel.
So they know exactly where to look.
Right. A guide basically acts as an ecological curator. They manage the safety of navigating the open water currents, sure, but more importantly, they translate all that visual data of the seafloor into an understandable narrative.
That concept of translation is fascinating to me, especially because the source material mentions another layer of translation built into this whole
What's
experience.
the audio?
Yeah. It notes that some of these excursions include a short audio narration. Now, usually when you think of audio guides, you picture walking through a dusty museum holding like a plastic wand to your ear.
Right, very dry.
Yeah. So implementing that in the middle of the open ocean while moving between islets seems unusual. How does auditory input change the physical experience of a boat ride?
Well, it bridges the gap between the macro and the micro. When you are looking at the coastline of an islet like Stragley or Macquarie, your eyes process the sheer beauty of it, sure. But without context, it just remains two-dimensional.
It's just a pretty view.
Exactly. The audio narration provides the historical and geological scaffolding. It explains, the tectonic forces that created the islets, the migration patterns of the marine life you're actually swimming with, and the historical significance of these waterways.
It's essentially an invisible augmented reality.
That's a perfect way to put it.
You are looking at a seemingly empty stretch of water, but the audio is overlaying the history of ancient maritime trade routes or the biology of the seagrass directly into your mind as you look at it.
And that cognitive layering is really vital because
Okay.
it prepares you for the ultimate destination of the journey. Because once you have actively scanned the horizon for wildlife and you've physically exerted yourself navigating the underwater topography at Stragley and intellectually engaged with the history via the audio, well, you need a place to land.
You need a minute to breathe.
Yeah, you need a space to synthesize the whole experience. And that brings the route to Ilimia Island.
Let's talk about Ilimia, because the sources paint a very specific, almost haunting picture of this place. They describe it as having a distinctly remote atmosphere, quiet coastlines, and just vast open space.
Yes.
The key word here is that it is fundamentally empty. But, I mean, emptiness alone doesn't make a destination compelling. A parking lot at midnight is empty. What gives the emptiness of Ilimia its gravity?
is the gravity of abandonment. I mean, Alinea isn't just a pristine, untouched rock. It has this profound history of human occupation.
Really? Like what?
Well, in antiquity, it was a strategic naval base. Then the Knights of St. John built a castle on its highest peak in the medieval period.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And during World War II, it was heavily fortified. But today, the island is completely deserted.
So you have this intense juxtaposition going on. You are stepping onto a landscape where human history was once loud and violently active. And now it has just been entirely reclaimed by the Aegean.
Exactly. And the appeal of Alemia is the stark acoustic and visual contrast it provides to the rest of Rhodes. I mean, think about it. When you are on a main tourist beach, you are subjected to constant sensory overload.
Oh, yeah. The club music, the jet ski engines, thousands of voices.
Right. Stepping onto Alemia acts as a form of sensory deprivation. The total absence of modern human infrastructure forces this profound acoustic recalibration.
That sounds incredible.
It really is. Suddenly the sound of the wind moving through the dry brush or the water just lapping against the pebbles, that becomes the dominant auditory input.
It forces your nervous system to downshift. I can totally see why the sources position this as the emotional anchor of the excursion.
Yeah.
Once you've spent days in the hyper-stimulating environment of the main island, your brain requires an acoustic dead zone to just reset. It makes the silence feel luxurious.
It really does. And it makes you feel like you have uncovered a hidden layer of the Dodecanese. You are walking among the ruins of past civilizations, completely alone, surrounded by the marine environment you just explored.
Wow.
The land, the history, and the water finally snap together into one cohesive picture.
Now, achieving that perfect cohesive picture obviously requires some practical execution. Let's look at the logistics outlined in the sources. The material defines the ideal traveler for this experience as nature lovers, couples, families, and those who want to actively enter the sea.
Right.
That tells me this is not a passive booze cruise. It requires a baseline level of physical and mental engagement. But the packing list is what really caught my eye.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it lists the obvious things, you know, swimwear, towel, sun protection, water. But it explicitly emphasizes bringing comfortable footwear and a light cover-up or extra layer. Let's start with the footwear.
Well, the footwear is essential because of what we just discussed about Alemia.
Right.
I mean, this isn't a manicured sand beach with a nice little wooden walkways.
Right.
It is a rugged, abandoned island with actual historical ruins. To actually understand the island, you have to walk it.
Yeah.
And that requires navigating uneven, rocky terrain.
Okay, that makes sense. But let's look at that extra layer recommendation because, I mean, we're talking about the Greek islands in the summer here. The Mediterranean sun is notoriously intense.
Yes, it is.
The ambient air temperature can be incredibly hot. Why, mechanically speaking, would you need to pack a hoodie or a linen shirt for a daytime boat trip?
This is a perfect example of where romanticizing the ocean crashes into the actual thermodynamics of the open sea.
Okay, break that down for me.
Well, throughout the day, you have been baking in the sun and swimming in the sea, so your core body temperature is elevated and your skin is damp. But as the afternoon progresses, the angle of the sun drops, reducing the radiant heat.
Right, the oven turns down.
Exactly. But more importantly, when the boat begins its return journey to Kimeros Skala, it is moving at speed across the open Aegean. And it's often cutting directly into those prevailing Meltemi winds we talked about earlier.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. The combination of wind speed and damp skin triggers rapid evaporative cooling. The moisture on your skin evaporates, drawing heat directly out of your body.
So within like 20 minutes, you transition from feeling like you are overheating on a tropical beach to shivering aggressively on a metal boat deck.
Exactly. The thermal shift can be absolutely brutal. So bringing that extra layer isn't about winter clothing. It's about creating a windbreak. It traps your body heat and prevents the evaporative cooling from crashing your core temperature.
It's such a small logistical detail, but I imagine ignoring it could completely ruin the psychological high of the trip.
Oh, it definitely would. You don't want the lasting memory of a profound ecological journey to be teeth-chattering misery on the ride home.
No, definitely not. And it really highlights the central theme of this entire deep dive, which is that the open water is not a controlled environment. It is a highly dynamic system. You have to adapt to its physics, its biology, and its history.
Absolutely.
Let's trace the arc of what we've unpacked today. We started by deliberately avoiding the engineered comfort of the East Coast, opting instead for the ancient windward maritime routes out of Kimeros Skala.
Yep.
Then we looked at how underwater topography creates a food web that draws apex predators to Makri Islet, which forces us into a state of active, mindful observation. We broke the surface at Straugrilli using guides and audio narratives to cure our inattentional blindness and actually understand the submerged ecology.
It's quite a journey.
It is. And finally, we grounded the entire experience in the acoustic silence and the historical ruins of Alemia Island.
It really is a complete inversion of the standard vacation model.
Yeah.
You aren't just looking at the water from the land.
Right.
You are using the water to truly understand the land.
And before we wrap up today, we always like to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Something that pushes just a bit beyond the source material.
Yeah. Consider the psychological difference between arriving at a destination by car versus arriving by boat.
Oh, that's interesting.
Think about it. When you travel by road, you are moving across an environment engineered specifically for your convenience. The friction has literally been paved over.
Right.
But when you cross wild, open water to reach an abandoned shore like Alevia, you have to subject yourself to the elements. You know, the wind, the currents, the sheer scale of the sea. Does the vulnerability of that crossing fundamentally change the value of the silence you find when you finally step onto the land?
It's really a question of whether friction is actually a requirement for awe.
Yeah.
Think about that while you pack that windbreaker for your next coastal escape. To you listening, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it helps you find your own wild, quiet corner of the world and gives you the tools to actually read the environment when you get there. We will see you next time.